Good afternoon. We're gonna play the airplane pretending I'm, you know, a flight attendant to make sure nobody belongs in orientation next door, okay? Okay, perfect. Just wanted, didn't want you to have to get up and walk next door. Welcome. This, putting up new, more chairs is a really good sign, right? So thank each of you for coming. Today's session is led by Chris, I'm going to say VR. I'm going to say Jeff KG all week and Chris VR because it's just easier. And then I get them mixed up, but they tell me that they have been getting mixed up since they met at Holden many years ago. So that makes me feel, I mean, they might just be saying that to make me feel better, but that's okay. So Chris, welcome. He has been coming to Holden since 1981.
Not quite that early, 1991.
See, I aged him by 10 years. I do that once in a while. So sorry. Ordained pastor and middle school teacher. Correct? Yeah. Somebody's got to do it, right? So this is a, both our sessions this morning were wonderful lead-ins to Chris's discussion about deforming the beloved community, a history of racism in early America. So thank you, Chris. We're thrilled you're here, and I'm running to orientation. Thank you.
Well, walking, probably not running.
And if we need more chairs, we will get more chairs and reconfigure.
All right, well, welcome everybody. As Sharon said, my name is Chris Boss Rothmeyer. Call me Chris. And I want to welcome you here. I did not really realize that we would be filling out the Creekside room like this, but I specifically requested the Creekside room because what I am going to do is more, it's certainly going to be some head knowledge, but it's going to also be experiential. You're not going to be sitting in your chair for 2 hours. And so don't expect that. And I see some of you with notes, notebooks and that kind of thing, and that's great. But there will be a time when you'll have to put those down and you'll have to interact with each other and actually talk. I will expect you to work. I expect my middle school students to work. And so let's begin. This session is called Deforming the Beloved Community, History of Racism in Early America. And if you came here to talk about the history of racism, you've come to the right place. We're also going to launch into some other things also to kind of tease out what it is that white privilege is, that being white, what does that mean? What is a person of color? What is this idea of racism? So, welcome. You know, before I launch in to this, I want you to turn to somebody and just tell them why you're here for, you think, 2 hours. Whether we go for 2 hours or not, I'm not sure. But you're here for potentially 2 hours on a beautiful sunny day. Heart Lake is 4 miles that way, but you're here to talk about racism. Can you turn to somebody to your left or right and just tell them why?
This is a conversation that can continue at dinner time or at coffee hour or that.
First of all, I want to recognize how much wisdom is in the room. Whenever I've done a workshop of this nature, I know that I'm not necessarily the expert, and that owing to the remembering the conversation in Gary's session just about an hour and a half ago, there was some real wisdom that came from the group, and so I want to recognize that. That's actually one of my assumptions. I'll show you what my assumptions are coming here in just a moment. But would one or two of you or three be willing to share why you're here right now to talk about racism?
I grew up in a household thinking that there was nobody in the world but white people, and they were all Norwegian. And most of them were Lutheran. So it's been a long road.
I teach high school in a predominantly white high school with students who don't truly understand the world they live in because of where they live.
Yeah. I can relate to that.
Good, we can.
We're from St. Louis and recently underwent, like in the last 2 or 3 years, and then noting the flare-ups of potentially riotous behavior, largely around race, I think some of the conversation has deteriorated. Black Lives Matter, we all matter, that the conversation doesn't always head in a very fruitful direction. And I think we're at a new age of some potential ignited language around race.
Yeah, we need to get some vocabulary under our belts. Go ahead.
I'm from Anchorage, Alaska, and we have the most diverse state, I think, in all the United States. Most people are of color, or intermixed, and the white person is a minority.
Yeah, that's an interesting dynamic, with the possible exception of Hawaii.
Yeah.
But good point. Point well taken. Yeah.
I was a professor at a private Christian school that crossed the threshold with a student body population of over 52% students of color and a faculty that was primarily white. And so being part of some really important conversations about race became the norm for us. And now I'm in Southern Oregon, where those conversations haven't necessarily been as prevalent. And I've been tasked to lead some intercultural developmental kind of inventories and studies, and I need as much knowledge as I can have.
Roseburg, by chance?
Medford.
All right. Mm-hmm. Well, let's continue that conversation. Why it is that you come here on a beautiful day? I did not nearly expect this many people. Mm-hmm. Here at Holden, and I've been coming here since 1990. My wife and I met here almost 30 years ago. And I know kind of the Holden way. We'll talk about sex, politics, and religion. What else would we talk about if we didn't have that to talk about? But racism, that's a tough nut to crack. And I think the same goes with our country also. To be able to talk about it with knowledge and with some humility and with a little bit of ability and willingness to listen to what other people are saying, that's kind of what we need. So much of what I'm going to present in this terms of this timeline comes from an organization you can find online called Dismantling Racism. But let's set the context, since this is our theme this summer. Can someone read the passage from Revelation, please?
He will wipe away every tear from their eyes, and death shall be no more, nor crying nor pain anymore, for the former things have passed away. And he who was seated on the throne said, "Behold, I am making all things new."
Now I'm going to try to weave this passage into what we're talking about this week, because I think this actually speaks to there's pain in what we've experienced. African Americans or Hispanic Americans, people of color, if you will, to put them in a broad range, are not the only people who have felt pain. People who believe themselves to be white, to use an author's terms, also feel pain. And so, he who was seated on the throne said, "Behold, I am making all things new." The question is today, is that possible? And how is that possible? All right, so what brought you to this workshop? We've already gotten there. Who am I? Why am I here? My journey in this topic has spanned several decades. I grew up in a white context, different parts of the country. But largely, I grew up with Lutheran influences, but we never went to church. So my entry into the church realm was actually more as an adult, if you will. But it was largely white. Whether it was in New Hampshire or Massachusetts, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, it was white, red, white. And so my first introduction to having people of color in my life was kind of college. I went to the University of Wisconsin-Madison, which has quite an international population. People on my floor in my dormitory were from all different parts of the world. After college, then, I lived and worked in a homeless shelter in Washington, D.C., and holy smoking cow, there was some differences there that I had not ever been prepared for. After I went to seminary, I spent 2 years here at Holden in 90 to 92. It's also pretty white here, so I guess I put my racial discovery journey on a hold for a little while. Then went to seminary, and of course, expanded out again in San Francisco area. Lots of diversity there. My first call right out of seminary was an inner city church in St. Louis. Multicultural, multiracial. I was 32 years old, and you know, don't they always put the new pastors in the most challenging five-alarm fire churches you can find? And And that was my situation. Susan was there with me. She kind of went through it. There were tears. There were really challenging times. And that was the first time I went to a week-long racism workshop where I tried to figure out what my assumptions and what my biases were in relation to the congregation. And I did not succeed. I got my proverbial butt kicked out of that congregation in about a year and a half because I did not know how to behave myself. I was still I'm wondering and learning. I was a pastor for 8 years in some pretty white congregations. The church doesn't do real well with diversity. And then I went into teaching because I wanted to explore that calling, and I don't regret it. My first teaching position actually was in a high school, in which the teachers and the students were primarily white, and then I was riffed into a middle school environment 10 years ago, and the tables turned. The teachers are mostly white, but the students are mostly students of color. And that's where I've stayed for the last 10 years, and it's been a journey. A journey to understand what is culturally appropriate, what are culturally appropriate practices, what culturally appropriate language is, who am I in relation to them. It's an ongoing journey. So that's me. This is a three-part series. I hope you can attend all three. They kind of go together, but I completely understand. If Wednesday you decide you want to take a hike to Monkey Bear Falls, please don't hesitate to do that. I'll know if I did a bad job today if there are three people here on Wednesday. But I hope that you'll get something out of today. All right. I'm gonna get you up and walking around, actually. I don't know how much room we're going to have in here. But I'm going to read a series of statements, and we'll call that the agree side right over there, and we'll call that the disagree side. So apologies to those of you who are in the cushy chairs, because those are hard-earned chairs. But I'm going to get you up. And let's just go ahead and say, if you agree with the statement that I'm about to give you, tend toward this side of the wall. And it's a spectrum. It's a continuum. So you can be anywhere in between also. And that side of them is the, nope, I disagree. No way, not even close. All right, are you ready? Mm-hmm. So go ahead and stand on up. Here's your first statement. Racism has been created and can be dismantled. Agree, disagree.
I'm kind of a lone ranger.
Not quite everybody. Agree, disagree. All right. Racism doesn't really exist anymore. It has largely been eradicated. Agree? Disagree?
You could give her little cards to
help. Yeah, okay, how about do that? I'll give you an agree and a disagree card here. Okay,
just
good
so
to go.
All
right, here's your next statement.
He knows we're all going back there.
All right, Christopher Columbus is a villain, not a hero. Agree? Disagree? Interesting. Take note of that. No, I am really doing this for a purpose. Later on, we will do something in relation to these questions. All right, here's the next one. White people continue to benefit from the effects of racism.
Wait, which one's agree, disagree?
Agree, disagree.
Agree is agree.
The task of dismantling racism falls mainly on the shoulders of white America. Okay. next one. White people today are not responsible for racist attitudes of their ancestors and shouldn't be blamed for the existence of racism. Agree? Disagree?
There's two parts to that statement.
All right, so you want to break them up a little bit?
Yeah.
Let's get rid of the conjunction. White people today are not responsible for racist attitudes of their ancestors, period.
Not responsible for, meaning not the cause of?
They're not responsible for.
Not responsible.
Well, there's no way we could respond to that.
We need to take care of. So we're just taking this first part. White people today are not responsible for the racist attitudes of their ancestors. Okay. Let's go with the second part of that. White people shouldn't be blamed for the existence of racism.
Shouldn't be blamed for the existence of racism.
Yeah, these are, you know, I came up with these at 3 o'clock in the morning probably. But yeah, argue with the question. Let's have dinner together. Okay. All right. We live in a meritocracy where we are individually responsible for our social and economic standing. Agree?
No.
Disagree.
Somewhere.
Race is real. Actual racial differences between certain groups have a basis in biological fact. Agree? Disagree?
Please God, tell me there's like no right or wrong disagreement.
I have an opinion.
Okay,
we can talk about this. All right. Affirmative action is still necessary as a means of leveling the playing field among people of different skin colors and ethnic backgrounds.
Sorry.
Well, I hope I got you to thinking a little bit. That's the end of the questions. Go ahead and take a seat. Again. Okay. Well, again, as promised, we're going to do something with those questions in a little, not all of them, but some of them that had a little bit more debatability, if you will. We'll do something with those later on. I also want to be transparent as I possibly can be with you, and just tell you what my assumptions are in relation to this topic. And the first one is, racist attitudes have been created, and they can be dismantled, but the effects of racism will always remain. So that one question where some of you were standing on one side and the other, it was kind of half the story. That's one assumption I hold. Another is that we have a perspective on race. Each have our own experience. Therefore, we are all learners and we're all teachers. And that is to respect you and the wisdom that's in this room. There are authors in this room. There are college professors in this room. There are people who've lived overseas in this room and who have way more experience on things than I do. And so I just want to respect that and honor that and invite you to share your experience, honestly. Okay. We all participate in racism even if we work to break it down. We all benefit from it even if we can work to break it down. And this reminds me of that image of, you've heard, of course, that if you're somewhat disorganized as you're trying to get a program off the ground, it's likened to trying to build an airplane while you're trying to fly it. Well, racism is the opposite thing. The airplane is in the air already, and we're trying to tear it apart. Can we land it that way? Can it land well that way?
Anna, you answer the question, maybe. We believe in a meritocracy. I would have stood, on the agree side. We do believe in our country in a meritocracy, but we don't actually have one. And then the final assumption, well, I have many assumptions, but here's another. Racism is difficult to talk about, but it is important to have the conversation. One of my favorite quotations of all time is Mahatma Gandhi, who said, "Whatever you do may seem insignificant, but it is most important that you do it." So, racism is difficult to talk about, and whatever we do to get our heads around this topic is most important. So thank you for being here. Thank you for helping me grow. Okay. I also want to start out with a couple of engagements. 3 days of two-hour sessions or so is a ridiculously short amount of time to kind of engage in this kind of topic because it assumes a level of trust. And for me to build trust among you all, and for me to you already gave me a certain amount of trust by coming to this session. What I want you to do is try to trust one another, to go into that place that you feel uncomfortable. Goodness knows I have. Goodness knows that I have made mistakes. I've said racist things. I have said embarrassing things in the various classes, workshops, and sessions I've been to. But I would like you to try those things. I want to encourage risk-taking behavior. If my 16-year-old son were here, his words would probably be, "Okay, Dad, promise?" But I want to encourage you to do that, to see this as a crucible, to see this as a place where you can try things on in a trusting environment with one another, say things that you wouldn't necessarily say in the outside world, but just try it. I promise to you that I will respect you always. So, I want you to stay engaged also, to speak your truth responsibly, to listen to understand, and be willing to do things differently, and to experience some discomfort. To expect and expect non-closure, and to be confidential. And within reason. You can talk to people outside this room, of course, with things that you're thinking of, but if somebody's sharing something, let that be their story. So I want to pause again and have you share with somebody next to you, which one of these are going to be the most difficult for you over the next 3 days or two, however many days you're here. Which of these is going to be the most challenging for you? Just share that with somebody next to you. If this was my middle school classroom, I'd probably ring a bell or something like that. Wait 5 minutes, 5 seconds or so, and wait for conversations to die down, and then would continue. Or I might do a little call response or something like that, but thank you. All right, so you don't have to share out loud which one you're going to have the most difficulty with. That's just something that I just wanted you to think about as we're moving forward. Okay, is it not working? There we go. All right, so in order to encourage risk-taking behavior, I want to offer you an opportunity to win a prize. This book is probably one of the more informative, short, concise histories that I've come across. If you know Howard Zinn, it's kind of along that order. This author, this is James Loewen, I think he originally produced this book in the late 80s. It's been revised, 2007. It's called Lies My Holden Facilitator Told Me, Lies My Teacher Told Me. And, I kind of joke about it in a certain sense. I show my kids the name of this book and they say, "You're teaching me lies?" Well, maybe. I hope I'm not teaching you too many lies. If you talk for any length of time, you start to think about things that you taught 5 or 10 years ago and think, "Man, how could I have ever taught those things? That's embarrassing. How could I have thought that?" And that's just kind of the process of learning how to teach better and growing as a teacher. But I want to offer this as a little raffle prize. And so, I don't know you all very well. And I want to try to recognize when I see somebody stepping out there with a little bit of a riskiness, a risky behavior, and I might give you I might write your name or have you write your name on a little post-it note here or something and put it into, for now, my backpack. I don't have a hat, but here's my backpack. We'll unpack that later. To encourage you to step out there and say things that you wouldn't necessarily say. Yeah, try to be respectful, of course, but put those thoughts out there. And I'm going to give you a little stick note. Or if you notice that, wow, this isn't something that I would normally say, you come up here, get yourself a stick note before or after the session, during the session, that's fine. Stick a sticky note in there, and on the last day, I'm going to raffle this book off. Some lucky person is going to get this book, 2007 edition. Okay, that's a lead into what I've got up front here on the display table. This is actually one of the books that's informing my time with you. I think it's a very important book. It's not the only one of its kind. There's lots of kind of revisionist history books out there, but this is certainly one of them. A couple others that I've got up here. This is a kind of an, you know, Trevor Noah, perhaps you know Comedy Central and that kind of thing, took over for Jon Stewart on... Jon Stewart. Thank you. Brilliant man. Grew up in South Africa. What he says in this book, he wrote it for an American audience, and it is very relevant to us, and it is partly going to inform what I'm going to talk to you about today. So, recommend it. Another book here by Michelle Alexander, The New Jim Crow, talks about kind of a modern way that racism and slavery is manifesting itself in our culture. Very, very important book, highly recommended. Ta-Nehisi Coates has gotten quite a bit of attention of late. He is a phenomenal writer. This book in particular is probably his most well-known, Between the World and Me. It's essentially a letter to his son about his own experiences growing up black in America and trying to give his son a little bit of advice and a little perspective about what that means. Ta-Nehisi Coates. Citizen, this is a book by Claudia Rankine. She's a poet. And so it's lots of blank space on the pages, but it's a dense read and a profound read in many ways. She's going to inform us. And then Brian Stevenson, who is a lawyer, and he has done quite a bit of work with death row inmates, death row people who are on death row. Most of this book is about a man that he was working with who was on death row, and he actually was successful with this man to get him off death row. But it's not just about him, it's about several others who he had experiences with. Very, in an interesting way, it's amazing how he maintains such a still a positive regard for the justice system, but he also critiques it deeply. So those books are the ones that are going to partly inform my session. The others, there are many others. How can you say what is all informed your session? But the two others that I would recommend are the books 1491 and 1493. Has anybody ever read those books? I didn't see them in the bookstore. Okay. But they're good historical understandings of what this part of the world was like before Columbus got here, and then what this part of the world was like after Columbus got here, giving a good context of what life was like. And it's a different one than many people understand. It's partly going to inform. I didn't have the book up here. Forgot it at home. But it's going to inform this session also. Okay. Every day I'd like to begin with this. And it's partly my hope to help us to understand who we are. So I don't know if you speak Spanish. Anybody in here speak Spanish? Okay, excellent. I wonder, you don't have to have the token Spanish-speaking person or the couple people speak the Spanish part. If you feel comfortable speaking Spanish, even if you don't understand all the words, although I've translated them into English here, then feel free on another day. We'll do this every day. But what I'd like to have you do is we'll have a Spanish-speaking person say the Spanish part, and then we'll all say Spanish in response. So if you would please just say the first line.
Tú eres mi otro yo.
And then we would all say...
Tú eres mi otro yo.
And then somebody in English. Can we have an English reader, please? Anybody in here know English?
You are my other me.
And then we would all say together.
You are my other me.
Si te hago daño a ti.
Si te hago daño a ti.
If I do harm to you.
If I do harm to you.
Me hago daño a mí mismo.
Me hago daño a mí mismo.
I do harm to myself.
I do harm to myself.
Si te amo y respeto.
Si te amo y respeto.
If I love and respect you.
If I love and respect you.
Me amo y respeto yo.
Me amo y respeto yo.
I love and respect myself.
I love and respect myself.
and share this with you in hopes, yeah.
We need the, one of those little deals with our name signed.
Good. Thank you for exhibiting good behavior, for being a positive example. So I start with this, is try to begin to build the trust among one another that we are who we are, and to see each other as our other me. Okay, is a profound way to begin the conversation about racism, which is so challenging and difficult in many ways. So we'll do this again. All right. So, what color is your world? In this exercise, you'll identify the racial makeup of your community, what you grew up in. I'll give you some categories, and you're going to have some post-it notes. Now, I wasn't expecting this many people, and I bought a whole lot of post-it notes from Target. And each of these colors, I've got six colors represented here. There are two stacks. If you'll notice, some of them have pink on top, and some of them are just all even colors like that. But there's two different stacks here. And my hope was actually to give each of you a piece of paper and to have it in front of you. And as I read the questions, you'll put a different color, a stick note, on that piece of paper. And you'll eventually see the kind of colors that this piece of paper gets filled up with. You'll see how this goes, but blue, we'll call this color blue because it mostly is, a little bit of green in there. This is African American. Yellow is this color, it's kind of a canary. These are similar, but they are different. Yellow is Hispanic. Bright pink, that's this one on the top, would be Native American. Green, which is, oh boy, I think I called this green. See how this one's sort of green and this one's sort of yellow? See how that goes? Can you all? Hopefully. But these are two different colors. This is the green one I'm talking about. This is the yellow one. Green would be Caucasian. Orange is mixed racial heritage. That's this one. And then light pink. Sorry, I wish I could find more more blocks with different colors on them, but we'll just put that in an other category. Sorry to be so generalized there. So what we're going to do is I'm going to ask you a series of questions about people who are in your community. And then you're going to place one of these colored pieces of paper on a white sheet of paper. I've got plenty of those for you. And you're just going to identify who influences, who colors your world. So each one of you gets one of these. Take one of these, please, and pass it that direction. Now, here's the challenge. All of the post-it notes are up here, and you are all out there. Again, I was thinking maybe I'd have 20, 25 people in this class. We kind of doubled that number. But somehow, you need to have access to these. I wonder if I can maybe place them in certain sections, and then you can distribute them accordingly. Here, only you guys can have the repository of those. So you'll get the hang of this in just a moment. Again, on this white sheet of paper, you're going to put the appropriate stick note color on the white sheet of paper, and I just want to have you take note of what's happening to the white sheet of paper as it gets filled up with different colors. Yeah.
Would you define community? Do you mean your family, your church, your neighborhood, your city?
Yes.
Or whatever. How far are you going with community? Because that will vary how far.
Exactly.
That'll determine my answer.
You're way ahead of me, and so thank you. It'll become clear.
Okay.
All right. All right, so let's get started. Oh, one thing. Some of the questions I'm going to ask have to do with individual people, and some have to do with larger groups of people. And so if I'm asking you about, for example, if you have 10 nephews and nieces of the same racial background, I'm asking you about the people in your racial community, if you haven't noticed. Place two post-its to represent all 10.
if your nephews and nieces are of different racial backgrounds, maybe five of them are one, or maybe there could be, you know, five of all different kinds, and five of a different, then try to keep the representation as even as possible. So with groups, you want to place five, or if they're all of the same racial background, put the two stick notes that represent those 10 on your paper. Okay? I think this will get more clear as we go along. So for this, I'm not going to tell you, the words were Caucasian. Probably should write them down. Those are the categories. African American, Hispanic, bright pink is Native American, green is Caucasian. When you first made it, this is going to be a challenge. I'll keep going back with this. So put your racial background, you. Put your proper color on this piece of white paper. Go ahead and do that now.
Is there a light pink?
This is the pink we have.
Yeah.
Oh,
okay.
Are you ready for your next category here?
Oh, there is a light pink.
Then your spouse or your significant other. Ready for the next one? Your grandparents. That's an individual question. I know you've got two, potentially four, or maybe even more grandparents. Let's go ahead and group that. So if all your four or more grandparents are of a certain ethnic category, racial category, go ahead and put two stick notes for them. We'll call this a group category. For group categories, we put two stick notes on your paper. So two. If they're half and half, then put one color and another color. But if they're all the same, go ahead and put two stick notes on it. I'll let you define what category it belongs to. Ready, one? I really thank Susan for helping me with this activity. Your family doctor. Your dentist. Are the post-its holding out?
No, we're just
running out.
No. Thank you for getting creative. Yeah. Your hairstylist or barber, who makes you look good?
Haven't found him yet. Your kids?
Yeah.
Wait, there's more. All right. Your employer.
Meaning your boss?
Yeah, your boss. I guess that would, because it's an individual question. Your boss. That's
so
a good way.
So you're retired, zero.
Yeah, right. So I guess if you don't have a boss, you're the boss of yourself. Right, extended family members. This is where you'll put two sheets of two post-it notes on your sheet, and think about your well, we already did grandparents, so let's do aunts and uncles. Let's go that far out, not so far out, not second cousins twice removed or anything like that, but cousins and uncles, aunts, and that kind of thing.
Nieces and nephews.
Yeah, let's do nieces and nephews. Yep. That's close enough. We're talking broad brush strokes here.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, do I need to keep going back to the colors, or do you have a sense of what they are? I can certainly do that.
We're good.
Okay. Your immediate neighbors to either side and across the street.
How many do we get to use?
Let's just use one to either side and across the street within a, like, go one house away.
But I mean, how many pieces of paper?
Oh yeah, this is a group category, so we'll put two down.
Kristen, what's my answer?
Yes.
Okay.
Twice.
That's landlord.
It's green, I guess.
The majority of your neighborhood, and we'll do these two together since I did them. The majority of your neighborhood, so beyond those people to immediately to one house away from you. And then friends that you socialize with on a regular basis. These are two group categories. So you put down two stick notes for each of these questions. Two for the majority of your neighborhood, and two for friends that you socialize with.
Does anybody need anything different?
I've got a whole other page here, but I'm not sure if the stick notes are going to go all the way. But maybe what I'll do is I'll just show them to you, and then you can just kind of think in your mind, what other colors would you put on here? Because I think you can see sort of a pattern coming up. Think about your faith community, and that's a group category too, because you hopefully worship with others. Employees at the grocery store.
Some of these are changing.
The police in your area.
Is that a group?
That's a group category.
Restaurants you go to, another group category. Again, you may or may not feel the need to keep putting down stick notes. So what I'm more asking you to do now is kind of think in your mind, what color would you put down if you were continuing to put down colors? You don't necessarily need to keep doing that, but just think in your mind as I'm calling out these categories, would it change the color that's currently on your white sheet of paper right now? Historical figures that you can name, another group category. The majority of images of Jesus that you've seen. Your mentor, if you have one. Actors or actresses in movies you watch, TV programs you see. Teachers you have or had. I have another one.
Light pink.
Yeah. Well, are there any other categories that you could think to add?
Your colleagues.
I'm sorry?
Colleagues.
Your colleagues.
Children. Mm-hmm.
People you work with. Yeah. Yeah, children. I actually thought about putting children on here, but I specifically did not do it. My thinking was that these are people that we influence and that we try to get to think like us. I don't know. Maybe they do, maybe they don't. But I was kind of focusing on the people who influence us and who color our world. Hopefully we color our children's world and they get to a point where they start coloring ours. But I didn't put children in there.
What if you have a service job? And so you service all these people.
Yeah. Right, so that would be colleagues, possibly. That's a good question.
I said children because we have two black children.
And we have
definitely influence our attitude about race.
Absolutely. So who colors your community? You bet. I've got two Filipino kids.
Right.
And even so, I did not include them because, you know, how am I raising them? Am I raising them according to their cultural Filipino background? Or am I raising them according to my white background? It's a question that I constantly ask myself. You know, they're certainly Filipino, but since age one, they've kind of been raised by us.
Sometimes your adult children marry, like my son's wife is half Chinese, and I know a family in Northfield, Minnesota, which is where St. Olaf is, very in our region, and we were talking with them. He was in the Peace Corps, he married a woman from one of the countries in Africa. And he was talking about all of his siblings had married somebody from either a different race, but maybe a different race, but also different countries, definitely, and the whole family. So your children might influence by whom they choose to marry and how you get to know that person. And
or simply the fact that my two kids are Filipino, and we lived in the Philippines for a time, but I'm attuned to the Philippines now and thinking about Filipino culture, and probably myself am training myself to think more like a Filipino to the best of my ability. But and perhaps you do the same with your two African-American kids. Did you want to respond to that in some way?
I think the culture treats African-American kids as black, which, I mean, in general, they come in with information from culture, perhaps more than lighter skin. Our daughter-in-law's Filipino, and she looks like a lovely white girl.
Excellent point.
So I think it could, whatever you personally feel is the impact on you might vary, right, personally, in terms of the categories.
So, go ahead.
Just to add that, you know, this is back
in the 60s were old people, right? So at that time, there were people in the black community who really had a big talk with us about the need to have your kids in schools that are black-white schools, neighborhoods that are black-white. Mm-hmm. You know, don't isolate them out in the all-white world. They really worked us over. And we took it to heart.
Great. So put two down for the kids. Absolutely.
Go ahead.
I think your faith leader, spiritual leader, you said faith community, but like hopefully that's somebody that is connecting with you and influencing you. And then, you know, because you brought up the authors, I think like the books you read, not just the people in the movies, but the big one I was thinking of is who are your representatives? Who's your mayor? Who's your president? Who's your senator? Yeah, your representatives.
Definitely. We could go on and by all means put your kids down because they definitely influence us in the way that we think and that. So go ahead and put a couple down for your kids. But I think you can see there may be a pattern. So the question I have for you is maybe just what thoughts and feelings came up for you. And we've already been doing that, but maybe rather than sharing out in a large group like this, go ahead and talk to somebody next to you and tell them what thoughts and feelings came up for you as you look at your sheet. What thoughts and feelings come up for you as you look at that?
I had another thing going back to categories is that you had African American, but now there's a lot of African immigrants that are even coming into the small towns in Minnesota. They are not really African Americans.
No. Yes, you're right.
They're African immigrants. Unfortunately, I don't have any on my thing here, but it is something that is changing a great deal, even in rural parts of Minnesota.
Absolutely. Take a couple minutes. Let's go 4 minutes and just try to take 2 minutes per person. What's coming up for you as you're looking at your sheet and did this exercise? What came up for you? What thoughts and feelings do you have? Try to take 2 minutes per person. I'll call you back in about four. Okay. And know all of the experiences, the life experiences that are going into those conversations and the wisdom. But I still want to invite you to come back, and we'll move forward. The reason I had you do this, of course, is because I think in any conversation about race, it's important to know where we are and who colors our world. The clumsy categories that I put on there, there's five of them, and they're ridiculously clumsy. They're very general. Over the course of the last 240-some years of our nation's history, we started with very few categories, and those categories have been growing over the several decades, and they'll continue to grow. And it helps us to kind of understand what is this thing called race? What is race? And what is it? What does it mean to be black? What does it mean to be white? What does it mean to be Hispanic? It changes, does it not? And even it changes right now. In just a moment, I'll kind of share with you a video that talks about, is race even a thing, or is it just something that we've made up? So actually, why don't we go there right now? Here we go. Oh boy, I don't.
But how would you prove it if someone disagreed with you? The fact is, even though race drives a lot of social and political outcomes, race isn't real. One of the first people to attempt to categorize humans according to race was a German scientist around 1776. He came up with five different groups according to physical appearance and geographic origin of their ancestors. Americans of European descent eagerly bought into this type of thinking around the same time. Some historians have said the idea that there were different races helped them resolve the contradiction between a natural right to freedom and the fact of slavery. If whites were their own distinct category, then they could feel a lot better about denying freedom to people who they've labeled black and decided were fundamentally different. But as political priorities change, definitions of race in America adjust right along with them. For example, if you were of Mexican birth or ancestry in the United States in 1929, you were considered white. Then the 1930 census changed that to non-white to limit immigration. Later, when the US needed to increase its labor force during World War II, these people were switched back to white. And what it took to be black, once varied so wildly throughout the country, from 1/4 to 1/16 to the infamous one drop of African ancestry, that people could actually change races just by crossing state lines. Then suddenly in 2000, the government decided that Americans could be more than one race and added a multiracial category to the census. This has left many Americans scratching their heads when it comes to selecting who they are. As many as 6.2% of census respondents selected some other race in a 2010 survey. The idea that someone might look one way and identify another way, or that they might be really hard to place in a racial category, is not new. This is why there was a public debate about whether MSNBC's Karen Finney could say she was black, or how we can't even agree on the racial label assigned to the President of the United States. Of course, many people feel their racial identity is very clear and very permanent, but the fact that some people have changed theirs and that no one can really argue with them shows how shaky the very idea of race is. This is all because there isn't a race chromosome in our DNA that people can point to. It simply doesn't exist. When the medical community links race to health outcomes, it's really just using race as a substitute for other factors, such as where your ancestors came from, or the experiences of people who may have been put in the same racial group as you. Dorothy Roberts explains that sickle cell anemia is a prime example of this. The disease is linked to areas with high rates of malaria, which include some parts of Europe and Asia in addition to Africa. It's not actually about race at all. This, of course, does not mean that the concept of race isn't hugely important in our lives. The racial categories to which we're assigned can determine real life experiences, they can drive political outcomes, and they can even make the difference between life and death. But understanding that racial categories are made up can give us an important perspective on where racism came from in the first place.
I guess my follow-up question to that is, what is race?
I'll throw it open to you if you'd like. Take a stab at it.
Well, the thing you always hear is social construct.
What was the original thoughts of putting that category on who you are?
In 1790 and 1790 census, there was clear categories for racial groups. There was black, there was white. And as they alluded to in here, the idea was to separate out those who were of one category and those who were of another. In our Constitution, written in 1787, we declared one category of people as 2/3 of a person. That's written into our current Constitution today. That's still part of our Constitution. I would argue that one thing that the first way we looked at people was just in the 1790 census, we tried to categorize two different kinds of people. In 1776, the very year that our country declared itself the United States, there was a man who came up with five different categories, a scientist. I don't know if I can come back to it, but Caucasian was among them. Mongoloid was another, and I can go into the other categories also, but people have been wrestling with what this concept of race really is. Is it according to skin color? Is it according to shape of the body? Is it according to culture? That, we're still wrestling with it.
Why are we wrestling with it?
Yeah, why?
It didn't really touch on some of the scientific aspects of race, just that it's something that changes, that over generations race changes based on where you live and, you know, those kinds of factors. And like, I think that's an important thing to hold up, you know, to people that, you know, might be thinking about there being, you know, key differences between races.
I think the government thinks it's important.
Why
do they wouldn't have a box to check?
Why do they think it's important?
Because they're all white.
It's politics.
I mean, for what purpose? Why are we categorizing people?
I think one of the issues here that the person was bringing out was that there are genetics, and in certain things like, you know, sickle cell disease, you do look at the person and you say, oh, could this person have sickle cell disease? And if they're black, you're going to put that in a differential of why are they sick and having all this bone pain. And if they're not from the Mediterranean area, that's not going to come in. So I think race as a concept is used, it will continue to be used. It doesn't have anything necessarily to do with better or worse. I don't want to see it used that way, but it is a concept that people use and it's not going to go away. I don't know.
Want to put it in the backpack there?
So often when we think about race, you know, we think about in the United States, you know, African Americans, because we brought them here. But, you know, when people started exploring and came to the New World, there was already a population of people here. And I don't know for sure because I'm not a historian, but from the things I've read or seen or whatever, they were already looked down on by the white explorers. They were all already considered savages. And although some things I've read is that at first, some of them lived in peace with each other, and then it probably, but you know that, I don't know, how many races do we have? Just like you said, are Native Americans a different race? Are they Caucasians? Are they are Hispanics Caucasians and all that sort of thing? I don't really know. But I do think that the white people that came over here looked at themselves as superior to someone with a darker skin, and that allowed them to obliterate many of these communities.
And we will definitely, I do consider myself a historian, we will definitely get into those issues more.
Okay.
You've come to the right place.
My grandparents were full-blooded American Indians from the East Coast, and my mother's, we never talked about our heritage, about being Indian. It was always, you know, we were white. It wasn't until about 10 years ago I had all my ancestors researched. Mm-hmm. My father was German, and we just never talked about it. Yeah.
I think we people like to categorize. We just like to do it. You give a child a bunch of blocks or Lego, at least my kids and every kid I ever saw, they first sorted them by color. Then they first saw and sorted them by one or two pegs. I mean, we just search for order, and race is yet another, good or bad. I think her point that if we make them inferior, then we can wipe them out and it doesn't matter. They weren't like us anyway, but I think kind of more, less pejorative way, I guess, is the word. We just like to sort. We like to sort in categories. It's what we do.
It hadn't occurred to me until you brought up the Constitution and the two-thirds category.
Is it three-fifths?
Three-fifths
compliments. Sorry, three-fifths. Is it economic? Is it based on an economic capitalist system of haves and have-nots, and you know, placing value on beings?
Yes. My apologies if I said two-thirds. It's a three-fifth compromise.
Yeah, thank you. Three-fifth compromise. Yeah, two-thirds.
Yeah, my bad.
Was that specifically for descendants of slaves, or was it also for Native Americans?
No, slaves, in particular slaves, and how they were counted.
They didn't even bother with the Native Americans.
They sure did.
They weren't.
No, they.
It was about putting how many representatives you got in the House.
Correct. Yes.
Yeah. Strictly, everyone got two senators, and they couldn't count black people as one because then the South would overwhelmingly add more.
Well, there's always going to be two senators per state.
Yeah,
the question was
representatives. Yeah, it's all about
the
House.
Right. Go ahead.
It's interesting to maybe think about if you started instead of the way it is now when we view with racism, what if you just started with people and then decide, do you need any segmentation after just recognizing everyone as people? But it seems historically that it's the segmentation starts to be an advantage to one group and a disadvantage to another. That would be my prediction.
Is that human nature?
It's about power.
I would say, unfortunately, yes.
I just wonder what might happen to categories as, in our nation, the Caucasians become the minority.
It has already happened.
It has, you know, but is it going to change over time as it becomes more so?
Well, we can take our cue in some ways from South Africa. Yeah, you know, who's to say? The white population there has always been in the minority. Arguably, countries in Europe are also now minority white.
Well, I think somebody already addressed it, but I mean, the whole comment of we like to sort, right? It kind of goes back to like creation stories, right? I believe it all comes back to power, and we like to sort because there's always some group that likes to be in charge. Like, you look at your 4-year-old who's like sorting everything by color and then by size, they feel successful and they feel powerful because, look, mom, this is what I did. Right? And so I think there's still that like creation myth of like, we like to sort things out. And if, I mean, look back at the Bible, it's all us them stories. We're the chosen people, they're not.
Yeah.
You know, we like to sort.
Yeah.
It's riddled in our history.
What you said was profound and great. What I also want to appreciate is something that you said, I believe. And so this is speaking your truth honestly, one of those agreements that I put up on the board. So thank you for saying, I believe this. This is what I think. That's great.
Yeah, here.
Put yourself in there.
I'm not here on Friday.
Okay.
Right here.
All right.
So my cousin was in Vietnam, and my father was in World War II, and so when my father was in World War II, he was with a group of people, and I think he said it was the first time he met anyone who was Jewish, and it was the first time he met anyone who was Mexican-American, and that meeting, that guy turned out, the Mexican-American turned out to be his best friend, and my cousin, of course, there were black and white soldiers in his group, and you know, once the battle starts, that just goes away.
Yeah.
But
once the battle's over,
it comes back.
Yeah.
It goes back. Yeah. But I mean, I think if a society sees an outward thing as a threat, sort of like all those stories in the Bible about the smiting who,
yeah,
then that can bring in a lot of cohesion.
Yeah. Yeah.
I would say in war, that happens, but the opposite happens. You got the Krauts in World War II, you have the Gooks in Vietnam, you have the Japs in World War II. You also create a barrier that allows you to do what you're doing.
In our country, going to Gary's session a couple hours ago was really helpful because we were wrestling with the question about how is it that Germany could have such a narrative, such a memory of categories. They categorized. Holy smoking cow, they categorized. And they categorized based on us. They saw us as the great example of how to categorize people and how to put some people in a position of lack of power and some people in the position of power. They took their cue from the United States. But after World War II, somehow, some wise person actually came up with a great theory in that session that I hadn't thought of before, but Germany rethought the narrative and rethought the way that they remembered. That after, if you're a child in Germany, you remember what happened in World War II, but you don't remember in order to continue it, you remember it in order to never let it happen again. But we haven't done that in our country. We have the narrative, we have the memory of slavery and of all the things that came before that and after that, which we'll get into, but we haven't changed the narrative. We've still got these racial categories. We remember, but not in order to change. We remember in order to kind of keep it the same way, or at least maybe even to retaliate. Not sure. There's so many reasons why we keep these categories, but they certainly definitely remain, do they not? All right, yeah.
My brother did a lot of research on the study of skulls, especially how it was used in the South during the Civil War, before the Civil War, to kind of justify slavery. And it's happened at different times, and people always bring up like Neanderthal, Cro-Magnon. It goes way back. Like, people try to say, well, these other races are descendants of Neanderthals, and we're descendants of Cro-Magnon, Like that stuff got in there. And it's interesting, like there's new research showing that actually white, like Europeans, if any Cro-Magnon group bred with Neanderthals, it's probably the Caucasians. Mm. And like, I think so much of this has to do with power and saying whoever's on top is more powerful because they're better scientifically in some way, genetically in some way. We'll just find different reasons for that. And I'm just like predicting that all of a sudden we're going to start seeing research about how great Neanderthals were. Really, Neanderthals were a lot smarter than we realized because the people in power, you know, have that connection. So
race is all around us. It's kind of like revelation in some ways. Once you start to recognize what race and racism is, you see it all around you. It is all around us. If you start paying attention, it's like God acts all around us all the time. And we just might think, oh, it's just some tree growing out there. You put a seed in the ground and all, okay, then there's a tree there. But then, you know, when you start thinking about, is that an act of the Spirit? Is that an act of God? And then you start to kind of orient yourself. This racism is kind of the same way. Once you start to see the race that's out there, you start to become more attuned to it. Reading the newspapers, in it every day. Go ahead.
I think racism increased in our country. I mean, the Romans used to take slaves when the people would lose a battle. Your choice was at the end of the battle, they could cut your head off or you could become a slave. That was your choice. So the slaves were all losers of battles. And that was what the theory behind importing them to our country. We could make them slaves because, of course, their other choice was having their head chopped off. After they had children, the Roman slaves' children weren't slaves because they hadn't lost a battle. But we needed a new narrative to explain why we needed them to be slaves, which would give this new argument that they had to be less than us. You know, part of that wasn't a part of the sort of the scheme. But there's, I think, a concerted effort to increase racism at that time, to make them less, so that we could treat them as slaves.
Okay, now you're getting into history, and that's what I really want to touch upon here. We've got, you all are outstanding. I really appreciate your input in that. 45 minutes, and I want to actually start talking about a little bit of history, a little bit of factual history, and that's in part some of the reason why you came here. The timeline that I'd like to share with you is actually put together by Dismantling Racism. And I've added and subtracted some things too, and I can't share this with you. If you ask me, can I have that timeline? You got to go to Dismantling Racism and ask them for their timeline. I'm actually using this by their permission. They gave me the permission to add a few of my own slides. The way I'd like to do this, though, first of all, I want to get at that question about what is racism. And it's not simply just one group of people taking their race and putting themselves above another people of a different perceived race. I want to break racism down into three categories. One, personal, another, institutional, and another, cultural. Personal racism would be when one person walks up to another person and says perhaps something racist or something that they treat that person according to their skin color. An example of that would be racial profiling, perhaps, which we've heard so much about. When a police officer sees somebody in a car and says, well, that person's a person of color, I better pull that person over. That would be an example of personal racism. There are lots of other examples. Institutional racism is racism that's built into the institutions that we currently have. Some of those could be housing policy, maybe the concept of redlining certain areas of our cities that we choose not to give loans to people, or maybe we charge a little higher for a loan for those people in this section of the city. Maybe people of color underrepresented or misrepresented on television. Maybe racially biased standardized tests. That would be an example of institutionalized racism. There's cultural racism also, which go a little deeper and into the realm of our beliefs and understandings, what we believe in the world. So one example would be women on welfare are assumed to be black or brown and are portrayed as irresponsible. Not to mention the people who are on corporate welfare, who are largely white, but we see them as largely, well, you know, that's what they should be doing, because making money is a good idea, and it brings us closer to God, in some people's idea. This is kind of an example of our belief system that influences how we treat other people of different race. Another example, requiring people to speak English historically. As a way of deliberately destroying community and culture. Save the person and kill the Indian was a popular way of thinking in, shortly after this American Civil War, the war between the states, if you will, in the 1860s. Great effort was made to kill the Indian and save the person by bringing them to schools and teaching them white ways. Cultural racism, institutional and personal racism. We will get back to these categories. They're going to kind of inform our entire time for the next couple days.
And since you're putting negative influence on those scenarios you just brought up,
could you think of a positive one?
Well, the idea and concept of assimilation to bring a community together for greater good and to do great things by building a community together, like win a war.
So that, what does that have to do with race? How to racialize that? Make, turn into race.
Your examples, they just sounded negative to me.
So have people said, well, okay, now all people of this race, let's go fight a war together. Let's all fight it together because that's who we are as a racial group. That,
no. I'm sorry.
My apologies if I'm not understanding you. But I'm just trying to understand racism in terms of I'm struggling to find out how
your examples of the Indians and brought into it your assumption was that it was a negative thing overtake the Indians. It was negative to another example is negative to make everybody learn English. You know, in a way, though, that we can't rebuild history, and those weren't totally negative concepts to have everyone speak English.
I hear what you're saying. You're saying that there's probably some well intention with it, or people thought that they were doing the right thing.
People thought
that
they were doing the right thing. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. And trying to build a nation of one. I mean, that's what E Pluribus Unum means, a nation of one.
So if we're going to have a unified nation with a common purpose and understanding, then what's wrong with creating a common culture and maybe denying, getting rid of minority voices or minority cultures?
But I think the difference is that the assumption at that time when that was happening, even though it was with good intent maybe to help with community, the idea behind it was our culture, white culture, was the better, and so therefore, in order to help them, they have to be like us, instead of saying, well, maybe they have some value too, and we'll let their culture include us, or we'll mix, or we'll share, and we'll integrate too, or whatever, but rather than one take over the other, is the difference.
So I just know my grandfather immigrated from Czechoslovakia, he worked as a butcher in the stockyards of Omaha when that was a big thing. And he wanted to learn English. He wanted his kids to go to school and be Catholics. But yet, they celebrated their heritage and their music and their culture, but they wanted to be Americans.
But I think that's the difference, is that the white people historically here in this country wanted to really destroy the Native American culture.
Well, they did it with such great intention, but it was a very bad result, right?
I don't know if it was good intention or not.
Yeah. No, not good intention. They set out to destroy their culture.
Yes.
Yeah. And I think the difference between your parents and my grandparents came over wanting to be American. They chose to just to not. I never learned German or Italian. Both my parent, well, my dad speaks Italian. He grew up speaking Italian, but he purposely didn't teach it to us. He wanted us to be like everybody else, and he chose to do that. I think the Native Americans never got that choice.
Well, the Native Americans were the Americans.
Discovered it before Columbus.
Yeah. Well, I also think we forget that the congregation, I served a congregation that one generation ago still spoke German. They've been here for a long time, but we're Germans, we're going to hold on to our German culture, we're going to do our German language. And no one looks at them and says, you know, oh my gosh, they don't want to, because they're white. And so, yes, you can be a proud white German, but you cannot be a proud African American.
We're getting into sensitive territory, aren't we? We can start to feel our anger and our emotions coming forth. My ancestors came here, and they learned how to speak English. They assimilated. Why can't Native Americans? You know, why?
Why wouldn't you be like my people? I mean, you came second. We would have saved the earth.
You weren't smart enough to learn Iroquois.
Still enough.
I don't think you can ignore the economic advantage of knowing the language of the majority culture. Correct? And so those things that were done to the Native Americans were terrible.
Yeah.
And the reasons they were done were not probably the right reasons. But you know, one of my Indian friends said the best thing the English ever gave them was English. Because on the Indian subcontinent, there's 100 languages or something, 80. Or, I mean, there's a huge number. And they could never be a country together until they had a common language, and their common language is English.
Mm-hmm.
And you see the same thing when you go to Canada and you go to Quebec. Mm-hmm. They'll take anyone as long as you take a course and learn how to speak French and some other things. So I don't think it's a bad thing to have people learn English and to be an advantage for them to learn English. I think it's a good thing. I think to ignore that is a big mistake for them.
Last comment, then I want to move forward because we've got a half an hour to cover something that I would want to get covered.
Go ahead. The predominant language was Inupia, and you use that kind of construct, I'd have to learn Inupia. And I did try, and it's
what a child could learn.
So I'm going to hand out.
That doesn't do me anything.
No, I agree.
What I was trying to make is, it's a myth that as soon as the different Europeans came here, the very first thing they all did was learn English. And why can't the brown and other colors do that? The whites didn't do it either. We just don't know our history. So the Germans held on to their German, and the Swedes, their Swedes, Italians, their Italians, and the new people coming over are no different. But we don't remember our own history, and so we look at them like they're crazy people. If they were crazy, then our ancestors were crazy because they did the exact same thing.
So let's talk about history. And this is a history of race from a certain perspective. You may disagree with it, and thank you for disagreeing with it. But thank you. What I'd like to do is have you think about what's happening in each of these touch points along history, a history timeline. Is it personal? Is it institutional? Is it cultural? Is it one person on another person kind of seeing their color or their identifying mark, however that you can define that, and putting them down in some way because of that? Is it something built into the institution itself and how the country is growing and how the country, our country, is becoming powerful? Is it having to do with our beliefs, the cultural understanding of racism? Does it have to do with what we believe as a people about other people? And the way I'd like to do this, I don't know if I'll have the opportunity at this point. Just think about those three categories for now. I'll show you the slideshow up here, and then I'm going to have individual people put along a timeline. I've started right over there. The slides are going to begin on that you've got the copies of the slides I'm going to show here, but a racial timeline begins there, and we're just going to kind of cover the wall this way as we move through the next 2 days. Wednesday, we'll continue the timeline. We'll work up our up until the Civil War or the war between the states. If someone could please read this first category.
The ancient Greeks differentiate people by culture and language, but not physical differences. In fact, the word barbarian comes from the Greek barbar, which means a person who stutters, is unintelligible, or does not speak Greek. Foreigners, including Africans, can be accepted as Greek citizens if they adopt the language, customs, and dress. Conversely, Greece, like Rome, is an equal opportunity society that enslaves people regardless of appearance.
Keep thinking about personal, institutional, and cultural racism. Okay, the next one, please.
1300. It is thought that the word slave derives from Slav, prisoners from Slavonic tribes of Europe captured by Germans and sold to Arabs during the Middle Ages. Throughout much of human history, societies enslave others due to conquest, war, or death, but not because of physical characteristics or national inferiority. In America, a unique set of historical circumstances leads to the enslavement of peoples who share similar physical traits and common African ancestry. Justification in terms of race comes later.
All right. That's the year 1300 CE. Common era.
Before Columbus set foot on this continent, before what is known as first contact, North America had hundreds of different indigenous cultures and almost 2,000 different languages. People had perfected the art of agriculture, were using irrigation canals, built dams, engaged in many of the same activities in agriculture advancements as people in Asia, Europe, and Africa. Families were matrilineal. This is a map produced by Aaron Carapella, which reflects the names of nations as the people in those communities named themselves.
Okay, the next one.
Columbus comes to Americas in the name of Spain. He makes four voyages, none to what is now known as the U.S. He carefully documents the voyages, including directions, currents, and descriptions of the residents as ripe for subjugation. James Lowen's book, Lies My Teacher Told Me, speaks of how the race construct begin here with this story. He notes how the 12 high school history textbooks most used in the United States offer a discovery narrative of an enlightened colonialism that brings the gift of civilization to the savage. This narrative ignores the ways in which Columbus truly did transform the modern world through the taking of the land, wealth, and labor from indigenous people in the Western Hemisphere, leading to their near extermination and the transatlantic slave trade, which created a racial underclass. Okay.
Michelle de Cuneo, who accompanied Columbus on a voyage in 1494, writes about what motivated Columbus to sail to the Americas. After we had rested for several days in our settlement, it seemed to the Lord Admiral that it was time to put into execution his desire to search for gold, which was the main reason he had started on so great a voyage, full of so many dangers. Note, Europeans did not come to the Americas by race, they came here by nationalities.
We'll get a little bit more into that later.
1607 CE. Jamestown, the first permanent English settlement in the Americas, is founded. Indentured servants from England and Africa farmed tobacco and cotton, but it soon became convenient to hold Africans in permanent servitude as demand for cash crops rose. Skin color starts to distinguish those who are in permanent servitude from those who are not.
1616, when the English first arrived in America, neither the colonists nor Indians think of themselves or each other in racial terms. On the contrary, Protestant England hated Broadville's Catholic Spain, while Native Americans see themselves as many nations divided by language, custom, and power. When the Powhatan Princess Pocahontas marries colonist John Rolfe, the union causes a scandal in the British court, not because Rolfe has married an Indian, but because Pocahontas, a princess, has married a commoner. In 17th century England, social station is more important than physical differences.
And I would argue that we haven't yet gotten to racism yet, where one culture, one person of a particular skin culture sees another person of a skin color as inferior. That's about to change, right here.
1640 CE. Three servants working for a farmer named Hugh Glenn run away to Maryland. One is described as a Dutchman, the other a Scotchman. The third is described as a Negro. They are captured in Maryland and returned to Jamestown, where the court sentences all three to 30 lashes, a severe punishment even by the standards of the 7th century Virginia. The Dutchman and the Scotchman are sentenced to an additional year of servitude. But in addition to the whipping, the black name named John Punch is ordered to serve his said master or his assigns for the time of his natural life here or elsewhere. Although the word white is not yet in use, white privilege begins to be established.
Many people point to this particular incident as the beginning of, because you are a certain skin color, you are in this position, a lower position. This was the first court case that codified it.
In 1676, in early colonial America, social identities are fluid and class distinctions trump physical ones. On Virginia plantations, European indentured servants and African slaves mix freely. They work, play, and make love together. In 1676, Bacon's Rebellion unites poor Africans and Europeans against Indians and wealthy planters. Although the rebellion is short-lived, the alliance alarms the colonial elite, who realize the labor system based on indentured servitude is unstable. Coincidentally, captured Africans, perceived as stronger workers by Europeans, became more available at this time. Planters turn increasingly to African slavery for labor while granting increased freedoms to Europeans.
1680, early colonial laws refer to Christians or Englishmen rather than whites. Around the time of Bacon's Rebellion in 1676, new laws begin to appear separating black slaves from European indentured servants. Slavery becomes permanent and heritable for Negroes, and black people are punished more harshly for crimes. Poor whites are given new rights and opportunities, including as overseers to police slaves. As the importance of slavery grows, white is used almost exclusively, not only in law, but other social arenas, and slavery becomes associated with blackness.
1705, Virginia slave codes passed, as wealthy Virginia planters turned from indentured servitude towards slavery. They began to write laws making slavery permanent for Africans, and dividing blacks from whites and slaves from freemen. The rights of African Americans are increasingly curtailed, while poor whites are given new entitlements and opportunities. Over time, poor whites identify more with wealthy whites, and the degradation of slavery is identified with blackness.
Okay, 1712, it's in quotes, "Act for the better ordering and governing of Negroes and slaves," end quote, in South Carolina. Quote, "Whereas the plantations of this province cannot be well managed without the labor of Negroes and other slaves, who are barbarous, wild, savage natures, and such as renders them wholly unqualified to be governed by the laws of this province, that such other laws and orders should in this provide be made, as may restrain the disorders, rapines, and inhumanity to which they are naturally prone and inclined. End of quote.
There's a lot of language there. Essentially saying that Negroes and slaves are naturally inclined to disorders and rapines and inhumanity. What is our belief system about people is starting to form here in as early as 1712 in South Carolina.
1765, free and enslaved Africans are aware of the moral contradiction between slavery and natural rights. Like their fellow patriots, they are inspired to press for their own equality. In Charleston, South Carolina, they march through the streets carrying signs reading liberty, liberty. One Massachusetts slave petition reads, every principle from which America has acted in the course of her unhappy difficulties with Great Britain pleads stronger than a thousand arguments in favor of your petitioners. In a letter to her husband, future President John Adams, Abigail Adams writes, how is it that we are denying people that which we are fighting for ourselves?
And I slipped this one in here just to let you know that the concern about how we're treating other people has been alive since the beginning of starting to treat people differently. Abigail Adams was one who asked her dear old husband, shouldn't we be advocating for the people that that we're putting down just like we're advocating for ourselves?
Takes a look. 1776, Declaration of Independence is signed, designed to organize white men of property. Existing restrictions on voting rights remain in place, limiting the right to vote to white male property owners. Catholics, Jews, and Quakers are barred from voting. Indigenous peoples and enslaved Africans are barred from voting. By the first presidential election in 1789, just 6% of the population is eligible to vote.
That's kind of institutionalized racism, would it not be? 6% of us could vote when our country became a country.
Women could get to vote either.
Of course not.
Only the rich.
1781, with notes on the state of Virginia, Jefferson becomes the first prominent American to suggest that Africans are innately inferior. I advance it, therefore, as a suspicion only, that blacks are inferior to whites in the endowments of body and mind. His writings help rationalize slavery in a nation otherwise dedicated to equality, and he calls on science to find proof.
In the Declaration of Independence, obviously, which Jefferson wrote, there was a line in there that had to do with slavery. It's not there now, but it was taken out specifically because people thought, nah, it's going to muddy the waters a little bit, and it's going to make our argument against England a little bit less direct. If you start having people question whether we should have slavery or not, or whether we should be treating everybody with equality, that's gonna muddy the waters. So they took it out. But the original Declaration had that line in there, that the slaves are, I don't think they mentioned the names, the word slavery, but it was people in servitude.
What was the line again?
Let me look it up. Thank you for that. Let me look it up tonight. I'll come back with it tomorrow, I promise.
1787, the Constitution is signed defining African-American males as three-fifths of a man and not mentioning indigenous peoples. It is during this period that the scientific community in Europe is creating the OIF, a race theory relying heavily upon the measurement of the brain and skull to develop four distinct races. The science claims that the larger the brain, the higher the intelligence. Those with the largest brains and thus the smartest are the Caucasoids, where our racial designation Caucasian comes from. Next is the Mongoloid, referring yellow people and those of Asian descent, Australoid, signifying rather brown people, and the Negroid, the lowest and the only category without a geographic location.
The Naturalization Act specifies that only free white immigrants are eligible for citizenship. The act expressly denies the right to vote or own land to first-generation immigrants from Asia, Caribbean, Central and South America, and Africa. Indigenous peoples become citizens through individual treaties or intermarriage. Without citizenship, people of color cannot vote, own property, bring lawsuits, or testify in court. All protections and privileges that white people take for granted. This act continues to have influence in various forms until 1952.
In 1830, white settlers claim more and more land. Gold is discovered in the heart of Cherokee country, providing the final impetus for forced relocation. The Indian Removal Act mandates the removal of indigenous people from east of the Mississippi River to Oklahoma, or what was then called Indian Territory. Over 30,000 people died during this forced migration, remembered by the Cherokee as the Long Walk Where They Cry, more commonly known as the Trail of Tears. Hitler admired the U.S. reservation system, praising to his inner circle the efficiency of America's extermination of these people by starvation and uneven combat, using it as a model for his concentration camps.
1833 Common Error. The American Anti-Slavery Society forms in Philadelphia. By 1835, hundreds of branches exist throughout the free states, and anti-slavery sentiment is on the rise. But as attacks on slavery grow, so do arguments defending it. Slavery advocates turn to scientific and biblical arguments to prove that Negroes are distinct and inferior to whites. Slavery is no longer described as a necessary evil, but as a positive good. The rationale is so strong that when slavery is finally abolished in 1865, the racial idea lives on.
And we'll talk about the racial idea that lived on. That'll be the subject of Wednesday.
Throughout the 1830s, slavery advocates turned to scientific and biblical arguments to, quote, prove that Negroes are distinct and inferior. Samuel Morton, the first famous American scientist, possesses the largest skull collection in the world, using the OID's theories developed in Europe. He claims the larger skulls of Caucasians gives them, quote, decided and unquestioned superiority over all the nations of the earth, end quote. As the black slave trade moves to England and then to America, the story of the curse of Hal moves with it. Presbyterian leader Benjamin Palmer, the emotional and the intellectual leader of the Southern American Christians, whose sermons and writings are widely published and read, preaches that the story of Ham, Genesis 9, is one of the series of the biblical justifications for slavery. Because Ham sees his father Noah drunk and naked, Ham is cursed by Noah to be a, quote, servant of servants. Ham's descendants, Palmer explains, are turned dark by the curse. Conservative Christians and segregationists argue that this and other biblical passages prove that slavery is part of God's established order.
Slavery is declared illegal in the Oregon country, but a lash law enacted in June 1844, which requires that black men and women in Oregon, be they free or slave, be whipped twice a year until he or she shall quit the territory. It is soon deemed too harsh, and its provisions for punishment are reduced to forced labor in December 1844.
The U.S. invades Mexico for its land and resources, Mexican-American War. The war ends with the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, transferring over 55% of Mexican land to the U.S. Present-day Arizona, California, New Mexico, Texas, parts of Colorado, Nevada, and Utah. The treaty promises to protect the lands, language, and culture of the Mexicans living in the ceded territory, but Congress substitutes a protocol which requires Mexicans to prove in court that they have legitimate title to their lands. Unable to provide proof in a culture that does not record land transactions, the protocol becomes the legal basis for the massive theft of land from Mexicans in these territories.
1854.
and the People v. Hall, so California Supreme Court reserves the conviction of a white man for murder, reverses the conviction, stating that these statements of key Chinese witnesses are inadmissible because no black or mulatto person or Indian shall be allowed to give evidence in favor of or against a white man. The Chief Justice notes that if allowed to testify, the Chinese, an inferior race, would then be eligible for citizenship, voting, and jury duty, which would present a great danger.
Dred Scott decision, 1857. The Supreme Court defines enslaved people as property, essentially saying Congress cannot abolish slavery because to do so would interfere with private property rights. They rule that descendants of slaves are, quote, so inferior that they had no rights which the white man was bound to respect.
The Homestead Act makes 50 million acres available at low cost to white working class homesteaders who fled Indian lands in the Midwest, forcing nomadic playing Indian nations to relocate to government reservations. The Act allots 160 acres of land to anyone who can pay $1.25 an acre and cultivate it for 5 years. Within 10 years, 85 million acres of indigenous land have been sold to European homesteaders.
That's the last one we'll do today. Maybe we can put those up on the wall also.
And, you know, I'm a history teacher. And history is, in many ways, subjective.
You may well, and I completely accept if you disagree with some of the things that I put up there.
History is, as they say, written by the victors, or by the teachers of a class here at Holden. But disagree with me, take me by the lapels. I invite you to do that. Do so non-violently, though, please. But what I'd like to do in our last couple minutes here, and I really appreciate your attention and attentiveness, and somewhat talk about, you know, think about the personal, the institutional, and the cultural racism that you heard over the last couple minutes. See if you can identify some of those things, just maybe one thing. See if you can identify with a person next to you one thing that was an institutional, one that was maybe personal, one that was cultural. Go ahead. And I was thinking maybe we wouldn't go the whole 2 hours, but I guess we did today. So, and that owing to the fact that there's so much to say about this topic. And I would, at the risk of saying share out and that kind of thing, I'll reveal to you my real purpose of doing this workshop. It is to get us starting to talk. Yes, that we're going to do a timeline. Yes, we're going to do some activities and that kind of thing. But we're talking, and that's my primary goal. However, I'll also reveal to you this, that in all of this, this is hard stuff to talk about. And if you leave my workshop today, Wednesday, or Friday, or however long you're going to stay here feeling guilty, I will have failed in my purpose. Because guilt gets us nowhere. Guilt makes us stay in a certain place and focuses on us, honestly. And that's not where I want us to stay at the end of these workshops. So what I'm trying to do is trying to help us see reality and move forward beyond that reality in a way that's not that in which we don't get into a guilty spot or just feel like we just can't move forward. So thank you for coming today. We will continue this conversation on Wednesday. Let's talk at dinner out there, coffee time, and that kind of thing. But let's get out of this hot room for now. Thank you for coming.